This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Broadcast Radio every Tuesday night from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to live shows or to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. If you do have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite, and all you have to do is go to the website for details on how to do that. It's a pleasure to have with us one of our favorite people on the People Speak Radio, and he's back with us for the second time. Our guest today is Professor Howard Zinn. Professor Zinn is one of the country's most celebrated historians. He is an activist, a writer, and a playwright. And he has authored many books, including The People's History of the United States. This classic work changed the way we look at history in America. He also wrote The Zinn Reader and an autobiography called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. As a playwright, his three plays are Emma, The Daughter of Venus, and Marx in Soho. He is also Professor Emeritus of History at the Boston University. Welcome, Professor Zinn. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be with you.
Indeed, it is an honor. Professor Zinn, the first time you were on our show, you made a statement that I've often repeated since then. You said, do something, do anything, just don't do nothing. Part of you, what you do, sir, is to impart the idea of activism within society. I can imagine that you've had a lot of joy coming from the new wave of conservative activism that's emerged in the country recently.
Well, no, it's interesting, you know, to talk about the new wave of conservatism. Now, we've always had conservatism. It's just that sometimes they're louder than at other times. And when they get very loud, also we mistake them for the majority, and we overestimate their power and the extent of their influence. I mean, they are influential, of course, for a minority of the population. I don't know how big that minority is, 20%, 30%, but they have so many radio networks and so much clout on television, have such corporate connections in the media that they exude a power greater than they actually hold over the population. So I guess what I'm saying is it's too easy to be intimidated by the loud voices of the ultra-conservatives and the right-wingers in this country because I think the American people, the great majority of the American people, do not hold the views that the ultra-right holds. I think the majority of the people in this country do not want war. They do not want the unequal distribution of wealth. They do not want people suffering for lack of health care or for loss of jobs. So I don't feel sort of set back by what people, you know, call the new wave of conservatism in this country.
You know, I found something that, you know, as I've been watching in the last weeks, this incredible resurgence of activism within this conservative party, and as you said, they definitely are the minority here, but they're making a lot of noise. My concern is that, and it reminded me of a time when, shortly after the Vietnam War, or during that period of time, when Roe versus Wade became the battlefield here in America. And I wonder, Professor, is this a form of reaction based on the fact that the majority of these conservatives allowed to happen under the Bush administrations, the 8 years under Bush, so many things that have altered the course of events across the world, and now they're really angry that they never did anything to stop it, and are venting their rage in this, and I'm using my fingers here liberally, quote-unquote, this health care frenzy?
Oh, there's no doubt they're venting their rage. And that's a good thing to keep in mind, that when they are enraged, they are enraged for a reason. And the reason that they are enraged is something good is going on, but something, that is, it's good that we're having a health care debate.
Right.
Which we weren't even close to under the Bush administration. It's good that people are at least discussing the idea of withdrawing our troops from Afghanistan. It's good that there are possibilities today which did not exist at all under the Bush administration. And even though these possibilities have not been realized, even though we are still foundering in the healthcare debate and not coming up with something right and clear and just, even though we still are at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the mere prospect of that policy changing due to public opinion, that prospect frightens the right wing, and so they go on the offensive, hoping to really stifle the voices of the people before those voices get strong enough to result in policy changes.
Yeah, it almost is a proactive form of censorship that's going on.
Yeah. They would like to intimidate people. Unfortunately, too many people are intimidated. In fact, people in the Obama administration very often seem intimidated. Very often, Obama himself seems to be sort of retreating in the face of a right-wing onslaught instead of meeting it head-on, challenging it, appealing to the country at large, and marginalizing this extreme right-wing.
Exactly. And may I ask you something, Professor, before you go on?
Sure.
This was
sure.
One of the most important questions that I wanted to talk to you about. You know, obviously, my first question would be your thoughts on the presidency as it stands today. That has really, in all fairness, inherited one of the worst political scenarios in history. So, given this, as you said, a lot of people are seeing the Obama administration retreat from their original very powerful message of change and strength and almost a cavalier attitude towards the right. And yet now, as you said, there's a marginalization of his own position, I think, going on right now.
Yes. I think there's a serious problem there in that this is true not just the Obama administration today, but it's been true for a long time of the Democratic Party, and that is, and I think of them under Clinton, I think of them under Carter, and what that problem is a lack of faith in the American people, a lack of confidence that the American people would understand bold, clear approaches in foreign and domestic policy. And because they underestimate the American people, they compromise, and they fail to come forth with the kind of strong policies that would appeal to the American people. And so I think what that does is to give those of us who are active citizens, well, so many of us supported Obama, many voted for him, worked for him. It gives all of those people who worked enthusiastically for Obama, voted for him, gives them, I think, a very important job to do. And that is to say to Obama and to his administration, you know, we worked for you. We helped you. Sure, you got a lot of corporate money, but you got our little bits of money, too, which you were proud of, that how many people contributed to your campaign. And therefore, we feel we have a right to say to you, we want you to fulfill that promise of change. And we want you to do it in this specific way, because the promise of change was never really accompanied by very sort of specific policy suggestions. It was, you know, it was kind of a general and inspiring call for a departure from the Bush administration, but it did not go into specific detail, let's say, about what would be done for health care, what would be done to give people jobs, what would be done about housing. And now is the time to follow through on that general inspirational call for change and give it substance by talking in very specific terms about policies that would represent bold change from what we have been doing up to now.
Professor, you once said in an interview that the next, or I believe it was an article, that the next big battle America was to engage in was the healthcare battle, and that the problems would arise due to the unfathomable amounts of money being spent on the wars that we were engaged in. And obviously that seems to be what's playing out. What part does the monetary system and the condition of our finances as a nation play in their rage over health care?
Yes, well, it's interesting that when you look at the health care proposals that are being made, and this very modest and really inadequate health care proposal, which is now being debated and which has apparently been approved by leaders of the Democratic Party, and you ask about how much that would cost, and it turns out that the cost of this is really insignificant compared to the amount of money we are spending on war. And so when people look at any health care reform and they tote up the cost of it, you know, and it comes out to, it comes out to $30 billion a year, or $40 billion a year. You know, it's an insignificant sum compared to what we are spending on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So there's a very direct connection between our foreign policy abroad, our military interventions, and our ability to say to the country, we are going to give free health care to everybody. Now, we could give free health care to everybody without worrying about cost if we simply stopped supporting the military-industrial complex with wars, with military bases in over 100 countries, with a huge military budget and with its billion-dollar contract to $600, $700 billion a year. That money that is being spent on the military could finance free health care for everybody. And so one of the problems with the Obama administration, I think, it's a very serious problem, is it is limited in what it can propose in domestic reform, limited in what it can propose for health care, for job guarantees.
Limited in what? In which way?
Limited in that because it is not changing course on militarization, on foreign intervention, on this existence of two wars halfway around the world.
You know, we have one question that's pertaining to this from one of our listeners, so I will go ahead and put this in at this moment. Elaine in New Mexico asks you, Professor Zinn, does Professor Zinn think that the war in Afghanistan is really about fighting terrorism or securing the oil pipeline?
Well, one thing it's not about is about fighting terrorism. And that's the last thing the war in Afghanistan is about. And it's quite obvious, I think, that you cannot fight terrorism, which is doesn't have a geographical location. Terrorism is something that can spring up from anywhere in the world. A very small number of people operating from anywhere in the world, including in the United States, can concoct a plan for terrorism. And when you react as the Bush administration did, and unfortunately with the support of so many Democrats, when you react by saying, well, we are going to deal with the terrorism of 9/11 by invading Afghanistan and bombing Afghanistan, that's absurd, you know. The result is what? The result is to kill very large numbers of people in Afghanistan, including many, many innocent people. More people have died in Afghanistan as a result of our invasion, certainly, than were killed in Twin Towers. The result is to kill large numbers of people, to displace hundreds of thousands of Afghans from their homes, hundreds of thousands, make them refugees, make them homeless. And the question then becomes, in what way does this diminish terrorism? In fact, it has the opposite effect. If terrorism is the result, and I think this is a premise you have to think about, and it's the premise I think that is not hard to prove. Terrorism is the result of anger against the United States. It's not anger against the United States because the United States is a Christian nation, or the United States is prosperous, or the United States has a liberty, or none of those nonsense reasons given, by some of our political leaders. The reason for these acts of terrorism is that the United States has been an aggressive, bullying force all over the world, and especially in recent years in the Middle East. And so they're
getting sick and tired of being killed, I think.
Well, you might say you get sick and tired of being killed. You get sick and tired of watching people around you die. You get sick and tired of your families being wiped out by American bombs. And that, what does that do? That increases the huge number of people in the world who are already fiercely hostile to the United States. And when you have millions and millions of people who are furious at the United States, a small number of those people will become fanatic enough to think that an act of terrorism would be a proper reaction.
Exactly.
Well, just as in our country, a small number of fanatic people in the White House think that the answer to terrorism is more terrorism. And, you know, this is something that I think that, here again, I'm sorry to fasten on Obama. He's not the culprit in our society, but he is the president, and he does have a responsibility. And I think one of his responsibilities, and he has not yet fulfilled this, is to point out to the American people, that terrorism is something that cannot be dealt with by invading and bombing any particular part of the world. Terrorism can only be diminished by the United States changing its policy in the world. You might ask the question, why are there countries that are worried about terrorism? Why is the United States the country most worried about terrorism? Why isn't Sweden or Norway or Belgium or New Zealand or Costa Rica, why are they not worried about terrorism? And the answer is, They are not aggressive, expansionist, bullying, war-making countries that invade other countries and that infuriate people. In other words, they don't bother anyone. We bother everybody. We have to stop
Unfortunately, they are mimicking the Israeli government. Obviously, the same thing is going on over there. Everybody's saying, you know, the poor Israelis, they have to deal with this issue of terrorism. Well, they're terrorizing a nation of people. So it is a natural consequence.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Israel, because when you examine Israeli policies and American policies, you find that they are very similar. The Israelis occupy another people. They occupy Palestinian land and take over Palestinian homes and humiliate the Palestinians. And then they're surprised when they face suicide bombers and terrorist attacks. You know, there are terrorist attacks. But then the reaction to terrorism should not be more terrorism. And it should be recognized that war is terrorism. War waged by nations is a much more devastating act of terrorism than anything that some small group can concoct. I mean, you measure the number of people killed by these bands of terrorists in the world, whether they're Palestinian terrorists or Middle Eastern, Saudi Arabian, whatever, or Irish terrorists or Sri Lankan terrorists. You measure the number of people killed by all these acts of terrorism in the world, and you measure that against the number of people killed in the last several decades by governments waging war.
Mm.
War is ultimate terrorism.
And it is the ultimate aggressive action.
Yes, exactly. And what war does is not diminish terrorism, but increase it. So you're left with an unending cycle of violence on one side, violence on the other. In fact, this is exactly what we see in Israel. We've seen an unending cycle of violence. We see Israel occupying the West Bank and Gaza. We see Palestinian reaction with suicide bombing. Then we see more Israeli bombing and more Israeli of violence, and so on, and the cycle goes on. And the only
Professor, do you think, in light of these statements that, you know, obviously look, we see what's happening with Iran, do you think that the United States is being forced into some kind of altercation with Iran based on Israeli needs and interests needs and interests, or is it a combination?
Well, I think it's a combination. Certainly Israel has undue influence on American policy. I mean, the result has been, of course, the American huge amounts of American military aid to Israel. But I think the aggressive stance towards Iran is due both to Israeli influence, which is itself misplaced, because hostility to Iran is not going to solve the Israeli problem of security. So there's the Israeli influence. And then, of course, there's simply the fact that the United States, in its constant quest to expand its influence in the Middle East, would like to expand its influence into Iran. I mean, well, we must remember, going back to 1953, going back to the fact that the United States secretly plotted a coup to overthrow the government of Iran. And why? Because the United States wanted control of Iran's oil. And so this quest for oil in the Middle East, this quest for military bases in the Middle East to protect oil interests, that still goes on. And so when I read that the United States is and Obama is playing into this, unfortunately, is keep warning Iran about the possibility that they might have, you know, a nuclear weapon. Well, it's possible that Iran might develop a nuclear weapon. So far they have not. So far they've claimed that the nuclear facilities that they're creating are for nuclear energy, and according to international treaties about nuclear proliferation, there's nothing wrong with developing nuclear facilities for energy rather than a bomb. But all of this hysteria about the Iranians possibly developing a bomb, one bomb or two bombs, when the United States has 5,000 nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. there's something ridiculous about that.
This kind of the origin of the proliferation agreements was based on mutual destruction. The fact
yes.
that one country that had nuclear power and another country that had nuclear power would not use these nuclear weapons based on the fact that they too could be victims of the same type of Armageddon. Now,
yes.
if in this case, does this not kind of set up non-proliferation as a joke somewhat, Professor, when every country that tries to develop nuclear weapons that isn't supposed to gets bombed? I mean, throw the whole mutual destruction argument right out the window?
Okay, of course. No, you're absolutely right. What people don't know, and unfortunately the American press and American political leaders have not educated the American people about this, is that the non-proliferation treaties call not just for other countries to resist developing nuclear weapons, they call for the existing nuclear powers to divest themselves of nuclear weapons. The United States is not doing that. And so while the United States and Britain and France and China and Russia and Israel, while they are not divesting themselves of nuclear weapons, they are not in a moral position to say to the Iranians or the North Koreans or any other little country, you see, that wants really mainly for reasons of national pride and to develop a nuclear weapon, have no moral right to say to these nations, well, no, you must not do this. Now we need to clean our own house of nuclear weapons before we demand that other people stop developing them.
Exactly. You know, Professor, we have a number of questions coming in from our listeners, but before I address any of them, I wanted to talk to you about something that I found that we have, and for those of you that haven't looked at our website, thepeoplespeakradio.net, you can see a small clip, a CNN video clip of Professor Zinn talking with some very famous guests, some very famous people, about a new film that's being created. It's called The People Speak. And I found that to be great because, after all, that's the whole, this is sort of the same concept of our own show. Now, The People Speak film is based on your book, The People's History of the United States. Mm-hmm. And could you tell us a little bit about the film and what's happening with that, Professor?
The starting point is my book, A People's History of the United States, and then we did a companion volume. Anthony Arnold and I did a companion volume of documents from American history, because in my book I had many, many quotations from historical documents, so very dramatic little nuggets. And what we did was expand that, and we produced a book called Voices of the People's History, which has about 200 documents. And then we have drawn from that book the most dramatic readings we could find, and enlisted actors from Hollywood and Broadway, very well-known, very talented actors, to read those historical documents. And we have been filming these performances. I mean, for instance, we have Kerry Washington, whom some people may recognize from her work on various movies, and we have her reading the words of Sojourner Truth, the black woman abolitionist before the Civil War. We have Marissa Tomei reading the words of a New England mill girl of the 1830s. We have Morgan Freeman reading a wonderful speech by Frederick Douglass, in which he explains why he is not going to celebrate the 4th of July. We have an excerpt from Johnny Got His Gun, this powerful anti-war novel by Dalton Trumbo. We have it read by Josh Brolin. We have Viggo Mortensen reading the words of a member of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, explaining in 1918 why he is not a patriot while America is at war. So I'm just trying to give you a little sample of the kind of things that go into this film. All of these actors, Danny Glover is reading the words of Martin Luther King and also reading the words of a poem by Langston Hughes, which he wrote in the early years of the Depression. We also have wonderful music in this film. I mean, music which is, of course, socially conscious music. We have Bob Dylan singing Do Re Mi, a Woody Guthrie song of the Depression. We have Eddie Vedder singing Bob Dylan's song, Masters of War. And we have John Legend singing No More Auction Block for Me and Bruce Springsteen, This Land Is Your Land. It's quite a remarkable, I think, collection of music and words, all of which is intended to give people a sense of the role that people outside of power have played in this country.
Professor, when is and it does indeed sound like a remarkable collection, when is this film due for release?
It is going to be shown on the History Channel in December.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it'll be shown on the History Channel in December, and they've been promoting it, and they've been publicizing it, and so we are actually now in the final stages of editing the film, but that's when people will be able to see it.
Well, let me tell you, for those of you that have recently joined us here at the People Speak Radio, our show was originally based on the fact that the people are the only ones that have the power to move mountains and to change the course of events in our world. I know Professor Howard Zinn, who is our guest this evening, believes this. I know I believe this. I know our producers and everyone affiliated with this show believes this. So this film, the People Speak film, is, I think, really quite remarkable, and I highly recommend everybody to look forward to its release on the History Channel. Now, we've got a lot of people in that are asking questions, Professor Zinn. I'm going to start with Dan in Canada. And he asked, do you perceive, as I do, that a new war with Iran is being manufactured in order to distract from domestic economic Armageddon?
Well, it's an interesting point, because it refers not just to the possible war against Iran, but it refers to the general history of wars and the fact that wars are used by political leaders to deflect people from the very pressing needs that people have and which governments are not able to satisfy. And so we saw, for instance, take the United States at the end of the 19th century when the United States went to war in Cuba. At that point, the United States had gone through a very severe economic crisis, which started in 1893. And the people large numbers of people were unemployed. Kids were dying of starvation in the cities. It was the height of, or I might say the depths of the free market situation, where there was no regulation of labor conditions, no minimum wages, where workers were exploited, immigrant labor was used, and people worked under the most horrendous conditions. And so the nation was seeing waves of organization among working people. And they were seeing strikes, and there had been a big railroad strike in 1877, great strikes across the country in 1886, big steel strike in 1892, railroad strike in 1894. So you had all of these domestic class conflicts going on, and the war in Spain accomplished what wars generally accomplish. They don't always succeed, but most of the time they do. That is, what they do is they deflect people's attention from the domestic problems, and they create an enemy abroad that everybody can unite patriotic around and concentrate on. And so in 1898, they created an enemy. The enemy was Spain, because Spain was occupying Cuba. And so the United States went on a crusade, presumably to liberate Cuba. Well, actually, while Cuba was liberated from Spain, they weren't liberated from the United States. But the war, what the war did was to unite Americans, not all Americans, because there were dissenters and there were protesters, but to unite Americans around the patriotic issue of war against a foreign enemy. And this has been generally true about wars deflecting attention from domestic conditions. So, I have no doubt that one of the reasons for a possible war against Iran is that it would be an attempt to unite Americans against a common enemy, and have them forget the grievances that they have against our own economic and social system.
Unfortunately, this enemy seems to be growing as we speak. First Iraq and Afghanistan, now Iran, perhaps in the future Syria. It just is growing and growing by leaps and bounds. We have a question.
Interestingly, we talk about them as enemies. I mean, these are small countries. They're not any threats to us. I mean, In the years of the Cold War, we could point to Russia, which was huge and had thousands of nuclear weapons, and we could use, and even there the threat was magnified and exaggerated, and the result of this exaggeration and magnification of the danger was to enable this country to build up a huge military machine. Mm. And you give it excuses, yeah, to go into Vietnam, to go into Latin America, all because we had this huge enemy, the Soviet Union. Well, these enemies that we have today are pitiful. And I mean, think of how easily it is that the political leadership creates enemies. Just remember, the Reagan administration created an enemy in Grenada.
Exactly. You know, the interest, it's so true, Professor. As a Palestinian American myself, I often am asked, you know, and I hear people talk about this horrible evil that is going to befall the United States if our enemies come here and put everybody in a burqa. And I listened to this and I said, for heaven's sakes, people, these are nations of people that can't even run their own countries. What on earth would they do with the United States?
there are fantasies that go on, and our job is to bring people down to reality. And
exactly,
because the political leaders certainly aren't doing it. The political leaders are helping to spread those kinds of fantasies, because our political leaders thrive on fear. If they can keep the population fearful of foreigners, and fearful of Muslims, and fearful of communists, and fearful of terrorists, and fearful of immigrants, if they can keep the population fearful, well, then this population will be controlled.
Well, I always said, you got to be careful, because one day America will have a burqa in every pot.
Burqa in every pot, that's pretty good.
You know, we have some more questions, Professor. We have a twofold question from Mike from Australia. The first part is that he asks, are online and interactive university going to become the norm in the future? And then he asks, I'm not an educator, just a parent, so bear with me. Can curriculum reference testing fit in with critical pedagogy?
Well, that's an interesting point. I like that phrase, critical pedagogy, because it suggests that there's something wrong with the kind of education which too often has been given to our young people, and which is not critical, which is, you might say, an acceptance of the status quo, an acceptance of the society in which we live, in which people are given an education which gives them certain skills, and the purpose of those skills is simply to have them fit into the existing social structure, instead of giving them a kind of education, which, as the great philosopher and educator John Dewey said, an education which prepares people to be citizens in a society, to become critical citizens. And when you base education on exams, on multiple choice tests, on factual information, mostly trivia, when you base education on the memorization of information, or base it on simply making people more competent to fit into the present machinery of society, well, you are bringing up a population which is manufactured to be obedient and submissive and not troublesome to the status quo. So we need a critical education, and here teachers can play a role if they will only be a little rebellious. Here the internet can play a role. All of these new forms of communication in which people bypass the major media, all those new forms of communication can play a role in bringing ideas, provocative ideas, and provocative facts, which have been left out of the usual curriculum, bringing them to the attention of young people, and, yes, creating a new generation which is probing and questioning and which asks the most fundamental questions about our society.
Very interesting. Yeah, I agree. You know, we have a question again, and we just addressed this. It's Harold from Pennsylvania. And his questions were about the upcoming documentary. And yes, Harold, the documentary, The People Speak, is going to be airing on the History Channel in December. For those of you that did not get that, I wanted to repeat that because I think it's very important. It's a very important work. Louise in Arizona asks, Professor, if Howard was an advisor to Obama, what would his top three pieces of advice be?
I'm sure Obama is listening to me, and therefore
yes,
I will give him my.
I'm
sure he's listening to your program. The top three pieces of advice. Well, I'd say one: go before the nation, and say that in order to diminish the hostility against us and the threat of terrorism, the United States is going to embark on a new foreign policy of peaceful relations with other countries, of withdrawing our military bases from all over the world, of no longer being an aggressive military power, of not priding itself on being a number one military superpower. No, we are going to use our resources to take care of people in this country and people in other countries who need help, who need medical supplies, who need to build up their infrastructure. Yes, we are going to turn away from militarism to peace. That would be my number one piece of advice. My second piece of advice to Obama would say, come before the nation and tell them that instead of giving them and proposing in Congress this very complicated health plan. I mean, you ask Americans today, what is Obama's health plan? And I'm sure you will find that. Can people explain it? And it's complicated. It involves insurance companies. It involves it doesn't really take us away from the old system of people filling out forms and people making co-payments and people depending on whether their employer gives in, premiums. And it's ridiculously complicated. And no wonder Obama cannot get a huge wave of popular support. So I would say to Obama, the way to get support for a health plan is to come before the people and say, I'm going to present something very simple and very clear, and I will call it health security to match Social Security, and it will operate the way Social Security operates. It will, yes, be a government-financed health plan. Healthcare will be free to everybody. There won't be any forms to fill out. It'll be the kind of health plan they have in other countries, in France, in Italy, in Germany, in Canada. Something happens, you go to a doctor, you go to a hospital, you don't fill out forms, they take care of you. Who pays? The taxpayer pays, but not you, the small taxpayer, the big taxpayer. The government pays for this health care system out of its national treasury, and it gets this national treasury rich enough to pay for this health care system by taxing the rich in a more serious way than they have been taxed. The rich have been floating on very, very generous tax breaks for decades and decades. So that's why we have this huge gap in the United States between the super rich and the rest of the population. So my second bit of advice to Obama would be to present this simple, clear health security plan and explain to them that, yes, this is government-run, but they should not be afraid of government-run things. It's public health in the way we have public libraries and public schools where the money comes out of the treasury and people don't have to pay for them. And we're going to give everybody the kind of health care that people in the military get. People in the military do not have to fill out forms. Well,
there you go. Now, that's a good one. That might certainly work.
People in the military get socialized medicine. You worry about socialized medicine, that's what people in the military get. And I would have Obama say very bluntly to the American people, don't get excited about the word socialized. We have a lot of socialized things in this country which are great, which are good. The GI Bill of Rights was socialized education. The government paid for millions of young people to go to college. And so there's a way in which Obama, I'm talking now to Obama, there's a way in which you, Obama, can get the American people behind you. You're very eloquent, you're very persuasive, and you can give them the information and the education they need to develop a very powerful popular force which congressmen and senators will have to listen to.
Well, that's you've really given some great insight into some of the basics. Thank you, Professor. We have a caller. Nico is on line 3, and he has a question for you, Professor.
Okay. I'll be glad to listen.
Nico, go right ahead, please. It seems like we've lost him on the air, I think. Okay, well, perhaps he'll call back. We have a couple of questions from Trevor from the Midwest. Trevor asks, please ask Howard what he thinks about the Supreme Court case dealing with corporate personhood. And he has another question after that that asks, what is there to gain by staying in Afghanistan?
Two important questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the caller is referring to the fact that ever since the 1880s, the Supreme Court has treated corporations like human beings. And human beings, persons deserving of the protection of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War in order to give protection to black people against racial discrimination. And said you cannot deprive people of property or liberty without due process of law. Well, the Supreme Court began to interpret this as meaning protection for corporations. And that has stood ever since the 1880s as the law. And the result is that corporations get better protection than ordinary human beings. And in fact, after the 1880s, there were many, many more times that corporations were the benefit of the 14th Amendment than black people, who were supposed originally to be the beneficiaries of the 14th Amendment. So we would need drastically to change that situation. Corporations are far from human. In fact, much of the time they're anti-human. So, and the other question about Afghanistan, well, you know, it's very sad that even people who consider themselves liberals will say, well, and this is to Obama, too, he says, well, the war in Iraq is not a war of necessity, but the war in Afghanistan was a war of necessity. Why? Why was it necessary to go in Afghanistan? It was absurd. And, you know, it was like a crime is committed and you can't find the culprit. And so you bomb the nearest neighborhood where you think the guy might be hiding. And you just bomb indiscriminately, wildly, to show that you're doing something. In fact, there were people who said at the time when we went into Afghanistan and if you objected to it, they said, well, we have to do something. Oh, really? You know, the doctor's going to just cut off somebody's arm when he's faced with an insoluble medical problem because he don't know he has to do something. So our war in Afghanistan, I mean, it has ruined that country, a country that had already been ruined by Russian intervention and English intervention, and now we are completing the annihilation of that poor country. And so, I mean, this is one of the worst things that Obama has done, and this started even before he became president when he promised he would send more troops to Afghanistan. And what it proves is that you cannot trust the people on top to do the humane and right thing, no matter how much education they have, you know.
Exactly. I guess Nico is trying to get back again. I hope this time the call will go through. Nico, please, your question for Professor Howard Zinn.
Hello?
Yes,
hello.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Hello, may I talk to the professor, please?
Oh, yes.
Hello?
We hear you.
Hello? Hello, may I call the professor, please?
Go ahead, Professor. I think he can't hear you, perhaps.
I can't hear the question.
Nico, do you have a question for the professor?
Yes, I do.
Go right ahead.
You're listening.
Yeah, okay. Professor, I am talking to you as an Arab Palestinian. Hello, do you read me? I am calling you as an Arab Palestinian. Okay, my question is this.
Go ahead.
Why United States of America foreign policy... Hello?
Yes, go right ahead, Nico.
Yes,
we're listening.
Do. My question is this. Professor, good evening first. Do you think America is capable now, financially and military-wise, to attack Iran? A. B. Do you think America...
Why? I think we've
yes,
lost.
I am with you.
Can you finish your question, Vico?
No, I don't finish my question. I am asking, is it the Jewish lobby, the AIPAC, who's controlling the White House and the Congress, controlling American foreign policy in Middle East to fight Iran or Syria or Palestinians, or it is the agenda of both parties, Republicans and Democrats, no change? And I call it is a racism to allow Israel and Europe has nuclear weapons and stop Iran from having it. Isn't racism or not? That is a racism.
Thank you.
Racism even in weapons. And that's my question.
Thank you, Nico. Go
sure,
ahead, Professor.
Can you summarize it for me? Because I couldn't really
well,
hear it very
I think
well.
He's, first of all, he's questioning the legitimacy based on the economic situation in the United States. Can we really afford to attack another country since we're already in two wars that we can barely sustain economically? And the other question I believe that he asked was that is this this alliance between Israel and the United States based on a form of racism?
Well,
against I think he meant against the Arab world.
Yeah, well, well, on the first question, can the United States sustain another war economically? No, it can't. It never has been able to sustain any war economically. What does it do? It goes into debt, it taxes its citizens more, it deprives them of social services, but the war has the priority. So sure, the United States can go to war, but it'll have a more devastating effect on the American economy, on the American people. Now, on the second question, is American foreign policy, you know, and Israeli foreign policy based on racism? Well, I think it's fundamentally a matter of economic and political domination, but racism certainly enters into it. And what happens, I mean, racism is a very insidious thing. Racism, it becomes, is a way of intensifying factors which are already in the equation and which lead one part of the world to oppress and attack another part. So it's just as, you know, in the United States, you know, there were economic reasons for holding on to slavery, but racism then was a very useful factor in intensifying and supporting that fundamentally a political and economic need for slavery. And I think so. I think that when you are making war against a predominantly Arab population, a Muslim population, or in the case of Israel, making war against Palestinians, and they are different from you in religion or and that, then it becomes very tempting and to then develop a, and useful to have racism multiply of a kind of intense hostility that you need to build in your population in order to carry on a war. So there's no doubt that racism is a factor in these wars in the Middle East.
Well, obviously I agree with pretty much all of that, and I agree that there is always going to be a certain amount of racism based on some form of elitism, I think. Professor Zinn, it has been a pleasure having you on our show again. A wealth of information there. I have 1,000 other questions that I wanted to ask you. Unfortunately, our listeners keep getting in the way. That's right, people. You go right ahead. You keep speaking. Let the people speak. Thank you, Professor. We hope to have you with us one day again soon.
Oh,
good luck with all of your work.
It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Next week's guest is Paul Peterson, former child star of the Donna Reed Show and star child active advocate. So we'll see you guys all next week. Until then, let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.